morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Later in the program, we'll hear from a Louisville filmmaker who's producing a documentary about the situation in the African Republic of Sudan. First, in the 1970s, America was swept up in a counterculture movement, and so was bluegrass music. The epicenter for that music was Louisville's Cherokee Triangle neighborhood, and now it's the subject of a new documentary. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports.
This 100-year-old Victorian red brick mansion with its small porch and bay windows is on a quiet street next to Cave Hill Cemetery. It's a fairly unassuming home today, but during the 1970s, it was the Bluegrass Hotel.
When I bought the house in 1975 and guys from the Bluegrass Alliance started living here, then this became the center of the whole thing.
That's Harry Bickle, a bluegrass fan and banjo player. He owns the house, and the thing he's talking about is a time when something called Newgrass music was taking root. The Bluegrass Hotel was an informal boarding house for musicians, including members of the Bluegrass Alliance, a band that helped launch the careers of Vince Gill and mandolin player Sam Bush. They'd jam in the cavernous rooms on the first floor and in the smaller bedrooms upstairs.
This is where guys would practice their music. And there was a big sideboard over there, and we had all the stereo equipment there and headphones and all that kind of stuff. So guys would sit here all day long practicing, sometimes with tapes. And we'd jam up here some.
Bickle says there were always musicians coming and going. Many paid upward of $35 a month, plus utilities. Others came with bands on tour and would crash for a few nights. There was a lot of beer flowing in those days and several eating contests involving White Castle hamburgers. Bickle says some mornings he woke up to find a dozen musicians sleeping on his living room floor. Sam Bush says he remembers playing at the house day and night.
To this day, I don't know if I've ever seen any healthier or, you know, more outgoing music scene than Louisville used to have.
The music scene included J.D. Crow in the New South and rock bands NRBQ and Dusty with Louisville native Tim Krekel. And it influenced the music played at Bickle's house. The musicians began adapting songs to bluegrass from other genres. They played Great Balls of Fire and Paul Anka's It Doesn't Matter Anymore. Other genres also inspired Newgrass Revival, a group of former Alliance members that formed in 71. It was the Newgrass Revival that helped introduce bluegrass to a broader audience, says Neil Rosenberg, who wrote Bluegrass, A History.
They did a lot of things with their music that other people hadn't tried in terms of arrangements and textures, and they really brought more to the palate than had been there before. And they became role models for a lot of younger musicians.
The music played by Bush and his cohorts, along with their long hair, caused a ruckus in the bluegrass world. The father of bluegrass music, Bill Monroe, said he would never book them at his Bean Blossom Bluegrass Festival in Indiana. But this up-and-coming class of musicians were welcomed at other festivals, where they performed original songs and covers of popular hits, including the anti-war song, One Tin Soldier.
Go ahead and hate your neighbor. Go ahead and cheat a friend. Do it in the name of heaven. Justified in the end. There won't be trumpets blowing.
Throughout the 1970s and 80s, the music caught on with crowds outside of the bluegrass world and with notable artists, including the Grateful Dead, Emmylou Harris, and Lyle Lovett. Through those years, Harry Bickle always welcomed them at his home. Now, the history of the Bluegrass Hotel and its role in the birth of Newgrass music is the subject of a film project with Kentucky Educational Television and PBS. Last week, producers and cameramen were in the Bluegrass Hotel filming interviews with Bickle and musicians with ties to the place. The documentary is slated to air next winter. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
What's all it said? Go ahead, nature, neighbor. Go ahead, Jesus. Do it in the name of heaven. Just about it. There won't be trumpets blowing. Come to judgment day on the bloody morning after.
Early next month, the President of the United States Senate will open the ballots cast by the U.S. Electoral College and formally announce the election of Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States. Kentucky has 8 presidential electors, and they gathered at the state capitol last week to cast their ballots. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh was among those witnessing the historic event.
God bless America.
The Supreme Court's mahogany-lined courtroom was the setting for Kentucky's Electoral College vote. Grammy-nominated singer Kenny Bishop kicked off the ceremonies hosted by Secretary of State Trey Grayson.
I bring greetings to the electors, to the audience, for attending today at this very important ceremony that's enshrined in our Constitution.
After a roll call, the state's eight electors were sworn in by Chief Justice John Minton.
The United States and the Constitution of this Commonwealth.
Representing the state at large are electors Robert Gable and Elizabeth Thomas. James Snyder represents the 1st Congressional District, Walter Baker the 2nd, Edna Fulkerson the 3rd, Amy Tolles the 4th, Nancy Mitchell the 5th, and Don Ball the 6th. After Gable was elected chairman, separate ballots for president and vice president were handed out, with the electors signing 6 copies of each. All 8 of Kentucky's votes for president went to Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona. All 8 votes for vice president went to Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Secretary Grayson says the votes from each state will be sealed and sent to the president of the U.S. Senate, who will open them on January 8th and read the results to both houses of Congress.
If a copy is not received by them, they will contact either our office or just Judge Kaufman here in Franklin County at the U.S. District Court to get an additional copy. So the copies are truly safeguards in case something were to happen.
All except Chairman Gable were first-time electors, but Walter Baker was carrying on a family tradition.
My great-grandfather was a lawyer from Greensburg named Thomas Waller Lyle, and he was a Whig elector in 1848 for President William Henry Harrison.
Elector James Snyder was also enjoying the process.
It's exciting to be a part of history and know that your name and your vote's going to be recorded in the Federal Register and that, you know, you'll be a part of history.
The Electoral College was created by the Founding Fathers as a compromise between election of the president by Congress and election by popular vote. To be elected, a candidate must win a majority of the electoral votes cast for that office. Some critics believe the system is outdated and should be scrapped, but Secretary Grayson disagrees.
The Electoral College, although it was founded for different reasons, has come to protect the say that many Americans have in the election process. Small states, rural voters have a say that they would not have, have influence that they would not have if we had a straight winner-takes-all traditional kind of election.
Chairman Gable wouldn't scrap it either.
If I modified it at all, I might consider doing it as I think Nebraska has been doing it, where each congressional district would cast a vote through their elector, and then the 2 at-large electors would cast the vote that the whole state had cast.
Kentucky electors are bound to vote for the winner of the state's popular election. That was John McCain, who grabbed nearly 300,000 more votes than Democrat Barack Obama. It's the first time since 1960 that Kentuckians failed to pick the candidate who went on to win the Electoral College vote. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
Coming up, we'll hear about a group of Louisvillians working on a documentary about the plight of Africa's Sudanese. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. A crew of Louisville filmmakers led by Corey Deeb is hoping to finish work soon on a documentary about the war-torn African Republic of Sudan. WFPL's Raj Ahuja speaks with Deeb about his Natus Films operation and the effort to finish the work.
Could you talk about Natus Films as an organization and how it came to be?
Natus was established about 4 years ago, about 2005, in the city of Philadelphia, after hearing a gentleman speak about the needs in southern Sudan and how they were just emerging out of Africa's longest-running civil war. And was a calling that I felt where the people were asking for help, and I was a person that could go there and film and photograph their needs, you know, document their lives and as a nation, as a village, what they were needing, and, you know, bring it back here to the States and do my best to raise awareness and to organize action. So NATUS began in 2005, it's been growing since.
So to the film, it's a documentary about the state of the Sudanese.
Correct.
Which is a fairly simple description. Can you expand on that?
I can. You know, there's a million documentaries out there, and, you know, we've seen a lot of them, and in fact, you probably have a dozen of them on your Netflix, you know, queue right now. And so, you know, what I think separates the New Sudan, or what will separate the New Sudan from a lot of worthy documentaries, is the fact that it's going to be a tool to help organize action, to distribute relief aid to southern Sudan, and specifically in the areas of water. You know, there's a ton of statistics out there, but one of them is that a girl has a better chance of dying at childbirth than she does at succeeding in middle school. And, you know, this is because of malaria, this is because of waterborne diseases. And so NATUS is wanting to use its awareness capabilities and powers through this film to organize individuals, organizations, churches to go to southern Sudan or to give to southern Sudan to help out in, you know, making some form of an impact in the water crisis in southern Sudan. Education is horrible there. You know, there's hardly any school teachers there, and if there are, they don't have the materials or the supplies that they need. And so we're wanting to partner again with individuals, organizations, and churches who have the ability to help impact southern Sudan for their future, you know, the education, the lives of the children there. And medical, you know, there's, I think, a doctor per 20,000 people in southern Sudan that are in need. So, you know, again, we're looking at ways in which we can combat the medical needs in southern Sudan, whether it be through pregnancy in women, HIV testing, malaria nets, putting up malaria nets, mosquito nets that prevent malaria in orphanages. And so, you know, the needs are huge, and what we're doing is just focusing specifically for 2009 in ways in which we can help combat this by releasing the film, by organizing and putting together an action plan, a way to fight the needs in southern Sudan.
So you described some of the topics that the film covers. What journey does the film take through its course?
We document the war and show the causes of the issues, and then we walk you through the lives of four individuals that we followed around for a month that we were there. And these are individuals who give us insight into the areas of water, medical, education, and the need for church development and church equipping so that they can better serve their communities. And so you can see for yourself, visibly and audibly, how, you know, this girl goes down to the river and draws contaminated water, and how she drinks it and cooks with it. And so, you know, the film does a good job of showing you, you know, the immediate needs of these people by taking you personally through every walk of their daily lives. And towards the end of the film, you know, we work at how to partner with NATUS and to, you know, lock arms, join hands in ways in which we can begin taking small steps and hopefully bigger steps in the future to combat these needs and to come together and work towards changing lives in southern Sudan.
So a film like the one you've done is a substantial undertaking. How are you able to fund all the work that went into this?
That's a good question. I don't know how we funded it. It's funny that you asked that, because today I'm writing proposals to a couple of individuals and organizations for our last needed funds to complete the post-production and distribution of the film. Man, it's been, you know, constant, you know, need of prayer to finish this film. We've raised a little over $50,000 so far for the film trips and equipment costs and post-productions, which anybody who does any type of film, whether it be small, medium, or large, knows that that is a extremely small budget for a feature-length film. And we've all sacrificed. You know, I'm working almost full time and not getting paid for it. My editor, William Wallace, has chopped down his hours or his finance, you know, his hourly wages to where, you know, it's what we can afford, but it's what he needs just to, you know, barely get by. And so we've all sacrificed a couple of real small grants here and there, but currently we're in need of about $20,000 more to finish up the film post-production to distribute it.
What do you see in life after this film for Natus and yourself?
Well, the film is not the end. To me, the film is the beginning. You know, for film companies who do a film, it's almost like, you know, means to an end. And for us, we are using the film as a tool to catapult ourselves into this fight, you know, to get involved with works in Southern Sudan. And so once this film is completed, you know, I think and pray that Natus will be put on the map to be able to pour its resources that it gets in through the film to our partners in Southern Sudan. If they need a hospital built, if they need a school built, you know, we could effectively do that because people here that would care enough to maybe give, you know, a small one-time donation or a monthly recurring donation. And so, you know, we're the middle guys. We're the middlemen. And so, you know, I hope that we're good enough middlemen where, you know, we can raise up enough support and awareness where our partners in Southern Sudan will be thankful for all the time and sacrifice that they poured into this project as well, being that they helped us film and woke up with us walking through the middle of the night, 3 a.m. in the morning, through villages with film equipment. And I mean, there's been an absolutely amazing amount of sacrifice poured into this film, and there's you know, nobody has benefited from it like you know some might think. It's a nonprofit organization with a whole lot of people working that aren't making any money, and so it just shows you the sacrifice that we're wanting to endure to be able to change lives, to encourage and equip people there, and to empower the church there that's just doing, you know, great work in the community and, you know, loving and serving both Christians and Muslims. And it's an encouraging project that we're grateful to be a part of.
That was Natus Films founder Corey Deeb speaking with WFPL's Raj Ahuja. Raj, by the way, just completed his internship in the WFPL newsroom. We wish him the best in his future endeavors. More information about Natus Films can be found at our website, WFPL.org. Supporters of the 82-year-old Delta Queen Steamboat are continuing their effort to return the paddle wheeler to service. The riverboat and National Historic Landmark was forced to dry dock October 31st after its federal safety exemption was not renewed by Congress. I spoke with Vicki Webster of the Save the Delta Queen campaign about its latest request for help from the Bush administration. Now, the Delta Queen had been operating up to this point under an exemption to an old law, is that correct?
Right. In 1966, in response to a disastrous fire on an ocean liner, a decrepit ocean liner, Congress passed a law called the Safety of Life at Sea Act that said that any vessel in U.S. waters having berth space for 49 or more overnight passengers had to be built entirely of non-flammable material. The Delta Queen was built in 1926 in Sacramento, California. She has a steel hull, but a wooden superstructure. The law was not meant to apply to riverboats because nobody realized she was still out there. It was meant to apply only to ocean-going vessels. So in 1966, everybody was given 2 years to comply, which, of course, the Queen couldn't. Congress gave her an exemption in 1968 because, as I said, the law was not intended to apply to riverboats. And ever since then, it has been granted temporary exemptions. I will never know why it hasn't been permanent, and I think it should be now. And they, each one has passed by virtually unanimous margins in both houses of Congress. They're essentially rubber stamp deals. And then in 2006, two things happened. One, a new company bought the boat, Majestic America Line and its parent company, Ambassadors International, which had a huge, not huge, a big fleet of ocean-going ships and Western riverboats that did not operate under exclusive union contracts. The previous owner of the Delta Queen had had an exclusive union contract, although owners prior to that had not always. That happened at the same time the exemption had passed the House of Representatives and went into the Senate. They did not have time to act on it before Congress adjourned. And after Congress adjourned, in the election of 2006, the Democrats retained one control of Congress. And James Oberstar, who had voted for the exemption that was sitting in the Senate, became chairman of the House Transportation Committee. He is, as are most Democrats, strongly under the control of the labor union leadership. And I stress leadership, not rank and file members, and I'll get to that in a minute. He immediately decided the boat was unsafe, having voted for previous exemptions. But we know, and it's no secret, everybody in Congress knows that it's a union dispute. The boat is being held hostage because the labor union leadership wanted Ambassadors to unionize its entire fleet. The company, in fact, offered to bring the union back on the Delta Queen, and the union said, no, it's all or nothing. So in essence, this boat is being held hostage because she's the only one that needs an act of Congress to continue. On a side note, Ambassadors put all of Majestic's assets up for sale last May. There essentially is no more Majestic America Line. The Delta Queen is for sale. The American Queen has been given to the Federal Maritime Administration because Ambassadors cannot carry the debt load they have on that boat. And all of their other boats, the Empress of the North has been given to MARAD. The other boats are all in long-term storage. There are no jobs to be had by the union or anybody else.
We're talking to Vicki Webster of the Save the Delta Queen campaign. Now, Congressman Oberstar has denied that this is a union issue. He says this is strictly safety.
That's correct. He's denied it. Congressman Steve Chabot, during the summer, invited Congressman Oberstar to tour the Delta Queen at any time or place that might be convenient for him. Oberstar never even bothered to respond to the letter. And he can spout safety all he wants, but the fact is it's not true.
So have you tried other legislative remedies?
We did. We've tried all the legislative remedies there are. We tried to get an amendment attached to the Coast Guard reauthorization bill back in April, and this was only a week after the boat was underway for the season. That lost by only 13 votes. And that was before we had any chance to get publicity because the season was so young.
So now you're turning your attention to the White House.
Right. Well, Congressman Boehner, House Minority Leader John Boehner, sent President Bush a letter co-signed by Congressman Chabot, Congresswoman Schmidt, and Congressman Jeff Davis of Kentucky, asking him to issue an executive order continuing the exemption. We do not know if he has the legal power to do that, quite frankly. We know he could not actually overturn the law itself. Only the Supreme Court can do that. But we think there is a very good chance that he can issue an order that would extend the exemption because it's been automatically extended for 9 times over the past 42 years.
So the latest exemption expired October 31st. Where is the Delta Queen now?
She's in New Orleans, tied up at the Perry Street Wharf, waiting to see what happens. There are people interested in buying her and fighting for the exemption and continuing to run her in her present capacity.
Are you getting any signals from the White House that the president might take action on this?
Well, we have not had a direct response to the letter. They have asked for more information, which we've given them, and we are asking all of our supporters to call the White House comment line or to send faxes or letters to the president asking him to act on our behalf.
And you say the Delta Queen is in New Orleans. Is she open for visitors?
Oh, no.
No?
No. She doesn't do that normally. She's strictly an overnight passenger boat. She is being guarded by security guards. So, mm-hmm. But no, she can't. You can't get on her. That's you never can during winter layup. I mean, she's normally laid up in New Orleans for the winter. Anyway,
has anyone ever considered just having her using her for day excursions and not overnight trips?
No. First of all, she's not set up for that. She can't handle that number of people. She's full of staterooms. She doesn't have the kind of open space that the Belle of Louisville has. You would have to completely gutter, therefore destroying what's great about her. And also, you could not possibly get enough income to maintain the boat. As you probably know, the city of Louisville has trouble maintaining the Belle.
Right.
The city of Cincinnati has a whole lot of trouble maintaining the Showboat Majestic, and she doesn't go anywhere. But no, she couldn't make enough money that way. And she definitely could not maintain herself as a hotel or a casino, because, again, to put all the get enough space and to put in things like elevators and ramps and expanded dining areas and expanded kitchen areas and expanded restroom facilities would cost a fortune. It would be ages and ages, even in the best of economies, before you could recoup that investment. And she'd be a second-rate hotel at best, because she's just, as I said, not designed to be a hotel. She's designed to be a boat, a riverboat.
So looking ahead, if you don't get a favorable response from the White House, what would happen next? Could it be presented to the next Congress?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, it could. And there's no telling what would happen. The dicey thing there is this whole problem this year, and this is the first time this has ever become a remotely partisan issue, because it's not a partisan issue. This is an irreplaceable piece of history. But the fact is that the trouble we've had in this year has been caused by the union-controlled Democrats. And next year, there'll be more of them than there were this year. On the other hand, Senator Obama did co-sponsor Senator Voinovich's exemption bill in September. So we are, if this fails, we are going to appeal to all the House Democrats and Senate Democrats on that premise. That and a number of other Democrats, Evan Bayh of Indiana, Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, signed the co-sponsored Senator Voinovich's bill. So that proves that this really is not a partisan issue. And if we can't get this, we will appeal to them on that regard. The problem is that Oberstar will still be chairman of the committee, Transportation Committee, barring unforeseen circumstances. And we know that he will never be in favor of this. There is a possibility always that we could do what we did in 1970, and that is attach a rider onto a broader bill that does not have to go through his committee and get it passed that way. That's always a possibility.
So in the meantime, the Delta Queen will remain indefinitely in New Orleans?
I don't know what. I have not heard of plans to move her anywhere else, but that, of course, is up to the current owner and any other buyer who may come along.
And we have a great interest here in Louisville because each Kentucky Derby week, the Delta Queen has been coming up for years and years for a race against the Belle of Louisville. So
we may
have to find another opponent next year.
Well, I can almost guarantee it's highly unlikely that the Delta Queen will be going anywhere in time for next year's Kentucky Derby.
Yeah.
It could happen because she's certainly in fine shape. If by some miracle, if the president does issue an executive order and we get a new owner quickly enough to get a season established, you've got to get all the marketing materials together and you know, get a booking office and all those kinds of things, there is a chance that she could have something of a 2009 season. But unless we get action soon, it's all but guaranteed that she won't.
We will be watching and see what happens. Vicki Webster, leader of the Grassroots Save the Delta Queen campaign, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick.
More information about the Delta Queen, including the effort to keep her on the river, and Congressman James Oberstar's House floor speech about the vessel's safety is available at our website, WFPL.org. Coming up, the legal case of Kris Kringle. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Wars throughout the world have been fueled by money from mining and oil businesses that's often unaccounted for. One notable example is fighting in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Human rights organizations and churches are working to tackle the problem. Through an organization called Publish What You Pay, they're encouraging laws that would require governments to publish what they earn from those businesses and for companies to publish what they pay to governments to extract natural resources. The Presbyterian Church USA is now part of Publish What You Pay, and in January it will bring Sarah Prey to Louisville. She heads the U.S. office of Publish What You Pay. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer spoke to Prey about the organization's history and efforts to promote legislation in Congress.
How did Publish What You Pay get started?
About 6 years ago in London, a few nonprofit organizations that were examining the link between natural resource exploitation and conflict began to see a direct link between the extraction of oil, gas, and minerals and corruption and conflict. And they all came together under the idea that if we could simply get more information about how much money is coming in to these countries, we'd be able to hopefully stop that cycle of corruption and conflict and be able to put those resources and that revenue to good use, to poverty alleviation and development. So under that sort of auspices, the Publish What You Pay Coalition was launched and has since really exploded. We're now in 30 countries around the world and have made some really significant progress.
What countries were the members focusing on and looking at, and what were the results of the corruption in these countries?
Well, I think some of the starkest examples, and again, we're looking at, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, was Angola and their extraction of oil. Human Rights Watch and a few other human rights organizations have looked into it and came to the conclusion that about $1 billion a year was going missing from those oil revenues. And this was, you know, in the midst of one of the, you know, most horrendous civil wars and internal conflicts in Africa. And so a lot of that money was being funneled to arms sales and buying weapons. Another example would be Sierra Leone and Liberia, where blood diamonds were used to fund those civil wars. And I know Global Witness, which is one of the Publish What You Pay members, was also looking at the timber trade in Cambodia and how that was fueling that conflict. So it really does span the globe and is all types of different types of natural resources, from oil to minerals and gemstones and even timber. So unfortunately, it is a very widespread problem, and the people that are suffering are the ones living in these countries that are often, you know, the victims of civil war and human rights atrocities.
You mentioned Global Witness and the Kimberley Process.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when Global Witness came out with their study about the effects of illegal trading in diamonds and mm-hmm. fueling of war in the 1990s, that it took quite a while to get the gem industry on board with that. And what finally ended up was the Kimberley Process, which is really a voluntary system.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, what kind of lessons does that give to publish what you pay?
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. The Kimberley Process has been incredibly illustrative for the Publish What You Pay campaign. Although the Kimberley Process, in a way, is voluntary, really, if you want to sell a diamond on the open market today, it needs to be certified. So I think although it has that voluntary component, it really, in a way, has become mandatory. And Publish What You Pay, since its inception, has said that if we are truly going to get a global standard for transparency and accountability, that it needs to be mandatory. And we have participated in a process, again, a voluntary process called the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which is very similar to the Kimberley Process in many ways. Basically, what it means is that a government will sign up, say that they will publish their government's receipts of natural resource revenues, and companies operating within their borders need to publish how much they pay. Those are internationally audited and made public. It is voluntary. There's about 24 countries in the world that have signed up to it. And while we find this to be incredibly useful, and like the Kimberley Process, there are civil society and industry and government folks all sitting at the same table participating in an equal level to ensure accountability and good governance. Again, we really go back to our original position that 24 countries is great, but we are really talking about 75 countries that are natural resource dependent and could benefit from this type of transparency. And to that end, we have really been pushing for something called the Extractive Industries Transparency Disclosure Act, which I know is a mouthful, which is a bill before Congress which would make it mandatory for any company that's registered here in the United States to publish how much they pay to foreign governments for these natural resources.
I know a lot of times in discussions about transparency and also making provisions for transparency into law that companies will say that there are certain facts, if they put them out there, that will make them less competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that's been an argument with this proposed law.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see in that argument?
You're absolutely right that that is something that we hear a lot, that, you know, by putting this information out there, they will be at a competitive disadvantage. We disagree for a few reasons, one of which is we look to the International Monetary Fund, which, as you know, is an international financial institution that created a set of guidelines on best practices or good practices for resource revenue transparency. And in that, they said these oil, gas, and mineral contracts are so widely known that this whole competitive disadvantage argument really falls flat. Because for the most part, once these contracts are settled, they become known in the industry and folks know how much is being paid to governments anyway. And I also think it's important to underscore that because so many companies, both American and foreign, are registered here in the United States, this won't put any specific country at a disadvantage. It's not like this is just applying to American companies. This is going to apply to European and Brazilian and Chinese and et cetera. You know, so it will apply to foreign companies just as it will apply to American companies. So we're not putting our American companies at a disadvantage.
And where does the legislation stand right now?
It will have to be reintroduced in the next Congress, and both of our champions, that would be Barney Frank in the House of Representatives and Chuck Schumer in the Senate, have committed to us to reintroducing it next year. Last year we had almost 40 co-sponsors in the House and almost 10, I believe, in the Senate, and it was introduced very late in the term. So we saw that as a really good sign that it will be successful in the next Congress. So right now we're just working on getting more bipartisan support and ensuring that it is passed in the next Congress.
And getting that support, is that one of the reasons that you're coming to Louisville in January?
Absolutely. And the Presbyterian Church USA has been incredibly supportive of the Publish What You Pay campaign. And, you know, they originally got involved because of their partner churches in Africa that signal to them that this issue is critically important to them, and it's just been fabulous to work with them. They're the one and only denomination that's joined the Publish What You Pay Coalition yet, hopefully the first of many.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Kramer speaking with Sarah Prey about the efforts of the humanitarian group Publish What You Pay. The 1947 film Miracle on 34th Street has charmed audiences for decades, but the holiday favorite is also a legal drama that has sometimes puzzled students of law at the University of Kentucky. Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton explains in this report that was first aired 3 years ago.
You see, they're having, well, sort of a trial about him.
You mean like for a murder?
Oh, no, no, it isn't that kind of a trial. It's just because he says he's Santa Claus.
But I've got a feeling he is Santa Claus, Mother.
Some people don't believe that.
Yes, Virginia, the 1947 film starring Maureen O'Hara and Natalie Wood is pure Hollywood, winning 3 Academy Awards. But nearly a third of Miracle on 34th Street focuses on a court hearing that's still debated by students of the law.
I chuckled when you called me because I used this particular clip of the lawyer having the mail delivered to Kris Kringle on the stand, the theory being that the post office is certifying that he could indeed be Santa Claus. And it's an interesting evidentiary issue.
Professor Richard Underwood, who's an expert on trial evidence, teaches at the University of Kentucky Law School. In the movie, a judge with the New York State Supreme Court is asked to commit a man named Kris Kringle to an insane asylum because he claims to be the real Santa Claus.
Age unknown. Old man, huh?
Very old, Your Honor.
I suppose I'll have to read all this.
Take my word for it. Just routine commitment papers, cut and dried. The man calls himself Kris Kringle. Thinks he's Santa Claus.
Things were more draconian before. People had fewer rights as far as mental competency. But usually those kinds of cases are brought by the greedy relatives that want to put somebody away and get their money. The idea that a department store would get involved in something like that is unrealistic.
Agreeing with Underwood is Kentucky Circuit Court Judge Bill Maines. Even if Kris Kringle faced a competency hearing in his courtroom today, the Round County judge says Kris wouldn't necessarily be committed.
The law now requires that you consider the least restrictive alternative mode of treatment as well. And so it'd be a much harder standard, I think, than that they were talking about back in 1947 when they made the movie.
Nevertheless, the prosecution proceeds, and just before Christmas, a hearing's held. Instead of dodging the issue, Kris Kringle's defense pivots on his true identity. If his lawyer proves Kris Kringle is really Santa Claus, then the defense can gut the state's case.
Anyone who thinks he's Santa Claus is not sane.
Not necessarily. You believe yourself to be Judge Harper, yet no one questions your sanity because you are Judge Harper.
I know all about myself, young man. Mr. Kringle is the subject of this hearing.
Yes, Your Honor. And if he is the person he believes himself to be, just as you are, then he's just as sane.
Granted, but he isn't.
Oh, but he is, Your Honor.
Is what?
I intend to prove that Mr. Kringle is Santa Claus.
He's crazy, too.
With that statement, Chris's attorney, played by nice guy John Payne, must prove the existence of Santa Claus. The judge then, with some heavy persuasion from political boss William Frawley, agrees to entertain further debate.
You go back and tell him that the New York State Supreme Court rules there's no Santa Claus. It's all over the papers. The kids read it and they don't hang up their stockings. Now, what happens to all the toys that are supposed to be in those stockings? Nobody buys them. The toy manufacturers are going to like that. So they have to lay off a lot of their employees, union employees. Now you got the CIO and the AFL against you, and they're going to adore you for it, and they're going to say it with votes.
Now, unlike 1947, we've completely removed politics from the courtroom.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, he was considering politics, but in actuality, he was considering economics, the economic impacts of him saying there was
absolutely
no Santa Claus.
I mean, you know, can you imagine... The last thing that any of these people would have wanted to do would be to call in question the existence of Santa Claus because the entire economy would collapse.
Judge Maines agrees. Politics and economics can be considerations in Kentucky courtrooms. However, he points out, judges have made some tough economic decisions before, and they'll do so again. As for politics, if they're truly a problem, in Kentucky at least, Maine says a judge facing re-election can always refer the matter to a jury.
Of course, Judge Harper being up for re-election like he was in that proceeding and being distressed over the fact that his decision might affect his re-election chances, the prudent thing might have been for him to have brought a jury and make that determination.
The question of Santa Claus seems to be largely a matter of opinion. Many people firmly believe in him. Others do not. The tradition of American justice demands a broad and unprejudiced view of such a controversial matter. This court, therefore, intends to keep an open mind. We shall hear evidence on either side.
The prosecutor eventually concedes Santa's existence, but then demands proof that Kris Kringle is indeed the real Santa Claus. The defense almost collapses. But a single letter to Santa Claus, addressed to the courthouse by Natalie Wood, sets off a chain of events that results in the miracle and created the legal issue that still puzzles Underwood's law students.
Hey, Lou, how many Santa Claus letters we got down at the dead letter office?
I don't know. There must be about 50,000 of them. Bags and bags all over the joint, and there's more coming in every day.
Yeah. Hey, Lou.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of nice to get rid of them, wouldn't it, huh?
Yeah, but... Hey, that's a wonderful idea, hey,
I mean, after all, why should we be bothered with all that stuff, huh? Why don't you get a couple of trucks up here, big ones, right away? Load them with all that Santa Claus mail and deliver it to Mr. Kringle down at the courthouse. Let somebody else worry about it, huh? Hey, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle bells.
The lawyer then makes the argument that the U.S. Post Office believes this man, Santa Claus, and it's an institution of the federal government. If they certify Santa Claus, he must be. And, of course, that gives the judge a graceful way out of the case. But the hearsay issue is this conduct like a statement? While they're not saying he's Santa Claus, their conduct is implying that it is, and can this be a hearsay statement? And it gets to be very theoretical. Of course, in a real case, a judge... If judges are like me, and a few of them are, they'd probably let the evidence in just for the sake of humor. Theoretically, there is an issue as to whether this is admissible evidence, and it's glossed over in the case, of course.
However, Judge Maines finds that the evidence is admissible. In his courtroom, he commonly accepts as evidence rulings made by other governmental entities.
For example, if a person can't pay child support and claims he's disabled, we may rely on a decision of the Social Security Administration that the person is disabled to support his contention. So, we do rely on determinations made by other agencies in other situations sometimes. So that is somewhat realistic. And, of course, those 21 bags of mail was pretty compelling evidence.
But the judge adds, not just anyone can be Santa Claus. As precedents, Maine cites a recent court case out of Ohio where a man wanted to change his name to Santa Claus.
And the court there had to make a determination. And let me just read this because it's priceless. The court wrote, and the court denied his request, said the history of Santa Claus, the North Pole, the elves, Mrs. Claus, reindeer, is a treasure that society passes on from generation to generation. And the petitioner seeks to take not only the name of Santa Claus, but also to take the identity of Santa Claus. Although thousands of people every year do take on the identity of Santa Claus around Christmas, the court believes it would be very misleading to the children in the community, particularly the children in the area that the petitioner lives, to approve the applicant's name change petition. Therefore, for the foregoing reasons, the court finds that it would be against public policy to grant the application of the petitioner. And he was not allowed to take on the name of Santa Claus.
Thank you so much, Your Honor, and a very Merry Christmas to you. Thank you, Mr. Kringle, and the same to you. Thank you.
So, unlike other Hollywood hits, Santa Claus is not locked up on Christmas Eve. He's free to roam the streets and perhaps the chimneys of New York City. But despite his day in court and the judge's favorable ruling, in the end, some doubt remains over Kris Kringle's true identity, proving once again the court of law can dispense justice. It can't settle everything. In Richmond, Kentucky, I'm Charles Compton.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio. a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.